This is Andrew McLean, creator of Headlopper and Apocalyptic Girl. You are listening to 11 O'Clock Comics.
Something in the air tonight, Jason.
So said Phil Collins.
I don't know. I don't know what it is. Isn't it weird? I love Phil Collins in Genesis. I have zero use for his solo work.
That first one. That's the most insulting thing. That's more insulting than when you guys made fun of X-Wave.
Why is it insulting to you that I don't click with something you love?
But yet we're supposed to just laugh off his Superman.
Right.
I don't hate Superman.
I wouldn't even use that book as a foundation to a woodshed.
First of all, if we count receipts, I am reading and have read way more Superman than Vince has in the last few years.
There's 100% truth with that.
But I'm talking about, you know, back when it was super good.
Yes.
Burn took over.
So what have you done for me now? It's lately.
And we're going to do something for the listeners because this is 11 O'Clock Comics, episode 918. And I'm Vince B.
You are Vince B. I am David A. Price.
That's true. And of course, I'm everyone's favorite draft analyst, Mel Kiper.
Wow. Okay.
NFL draft tonight, Vince. You wouldn't know that, but most of our listeners will know that.
No.
Most of our listeners will.
That mothership sailed right over my head.
Yeah.
You're
Mel Kiper
not...
is the ESPN analyst who covers the draft for them. Yeah.
You're not...
Come on.
You're not Mel Kiper. You're Jason Wood.
Not Mel Kiper, you bitch. Mel Kiper, Jesus.
Jeez. Dallin and Septic, what are you doing to me?
Septic.
You're Jason Wood, everybody. It's next week. Here together, once again, on a little shindig sponsored by CheapGraphicNovels.com. That is CheapGraphicNovels.com, where you can get all the book for a fraction of the price. You know the list by now. Trade paperbacks, manga, OGNs, Omnibus Edition, the new hotness of the Omnibus Edition, and Max has them all at drastically reduced prices. You can even pre-order stuff there. I don't know if the Marvel sale is still going on, but it was. I'm sure it is. And it was, wow, just delicious prices on Marvel trade paperbacks and hardcovers. So get yourself over there, cheapgraphicnovels.com, and save like a bandit. And I'll tell you a little secret at the end of the episode that you can save even more. How's that? Cliffhanger. Instead of saying instead of saying it twice, I'll just follow up on the back end like I do. Yeah.
You do.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
That's how it be.
And I'm drinking some blackberry lemonade.
That sounds delightful. Oh,
it is excitement for the tongue. Nothing makes my taste buds tingle like the blackberry lemonade from Clear American.
I do prefer my lemonade to have another fruit with it, like raspberry or blackberry.
Yeah, I've grown to love lemonade.
It's the cool, refreshing drink, per Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, it is. And the king.
It's really the only. It's the only fountain drink that I'll bother with when we're at, like, well, the machine at Five Guys or the theater or something like that. Because I don't drink soda, so I have to. It's either lemonade or occasionally ginger ale.
We're gonna win this race.
Jason, you drinking, Jason?
Boy, look, might have kicked them jeans. No, okay. I'm drinking lemon lime G0.
Okay.
NFL draft. You got to drink Gatorade during the NFL draft.
Wait a minute.
You got it.
What do you mean during the NFL draft?
NFL draft? I just got done saying.
No, I know, but is this NFL draft playing out in the background?
Yes, of course it is.
What the hell?
Are you kidding me right now?
If we can't command your attention, this is bullshit. This is complete bullshit. This is me watching Dracula in the background. Like, what?
This is the Venn diagram, Vince, because this is two, three passions right here on the same night. So,
sure. Who's not commanding your attention? I am enwrapped with what we're about to talk about.
For especially since it's like an idea, so yeah.
And you he'll wonder be, why your audio's cursed. You wonder. Ooh. I'm just saying.
Now we're getting personal. I see.
Okay. You're bringing down the hoodoo on you.
Okay. Let's keep
it. I didn't do it. Something's doing it.
This is a limited edition. I love the label on this. I love the name on the label also. But Venus in Furs. It is a bourbon barrel aged red wine from Chile.
Jess Franco.
It is a red blend. Aged 4 months in Kentucky bourbon barrels. I picked it up completely on a whim because I saw Venus in Furs and I was like, that's pretty cool. And
never seen the film, right?
I've never seen the film.
Ooh. Okay.
It is a, I'm sorry, it's a red blend with, what the fuck's this say? Cabernet Sauvignon and Syrah.
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 Syrah, Jason.
Syrah.
Just people playing at home, Jason had an idea for this week.
That's right.
For once, Jason came up with something.
Yep.
That I think is pretty exciting. And so we ran with it. It's a concept for this week. Jason's going to tell you all about it.
Well, we were talking about, behind the scenes, we three of us were talking about a certain collected edition that we were very excited that's finally out. And we were just talking a bit about how, like, certain people involved in that are probably not getting the love that they deserve, you know?
Very, very true.
And so I thought it might be fun because people do love the lists, doing the lists, you know, when it's something, you know, to make our brains go a little bit deeper into the vaults of all of these years of reading comics. And I said, what if we did a little discussion about our most underappreciated creators in history? Writers or artists, doesn't have to be. Be either, right? No, it could be. And for Dap, it could be an anchor. Who knows?
I have an anchor on mine.
Okay.
You should.
But yeah, so we are gonna present, each of us have a list of five peeps who we think are the most underrated or underappreciated. You know, it's kind of catch as catch can. But I was informed before we started this recording that you both have some rules that you put upon your structure of your pick. So why don't you talk to the people? Because I didn't particularly, I kind of went with sort of, I just cleared my head, wrote down 15 to 20 that came to mind over the next like half hour. And then from that list kind of, you know, parsed through it till I got to five that I thought were the ones I wanted to talk about. So maybe you guys had a different approach.
Well, in cobbling together my list, there was one name that I'm like, I need to put this guy on here because I love this thing that he did many years ago. And he's on the list. And then as I was fleshing out the list, I thought, wait a minute, this guy is near and dear to me, but is he underappreciated, really? So the magnitude of what I considered the underappreciated factors plays into it, because I'll tell you right now, just to illustrate my process, I wanted to put Len Kaminsky on the list just for Ghost Rider 2099. And then I thought about Len Kaminsky's other work, which is not special to me.
Yeah.
Or I don't think it's all that novel. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't think it was as worthy as garnering the spotlight as these other people that are on my list. I love Ghost Rider 2099, but I think it's the high spot in his oeuvre. So I looked at the other stuff like War Machine as a
slapstick.
Yeah, so you know, Creeper, stuff like that I enjoyed, but I don't think they were as groundbreaking as Ghost Rider 2099. So he didn't make the list. Then I was thinking, well, Richard Corbin has to be on the list. But I thought about it. Does Richard Corbin is he really underappreciated? Maybe not so much now, with the reprintings of Dan and all the books that are slated to come out. And Corbin's an artist. So industry people know and respect and marvel at Corbin's work. And it's starting to pervade into the fan sector. So it's okay. I didn't put Corbin on the list. Maybe 5-7 years ago, I would think it would be great to put Corbin on the list because he was just making those books for Dark Horse, and they seemed to go overlooked, right? But I think, unfortunately, with his passing, I think more people are keyed into the joys of Richard Corbin now than at any time in the past 10 years.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I actually, when I was making my list, I thought, oh, Vince is going to have Corbin on his list. But your explanation makes sense, though.
Right, but I think all of the ones I have on my list are super heavy hitters. Like, there's really no reason why most of these names aren't household, especially my first one.
Okay, nice. I'm loving this, yeah. And how about you, Dad?
Well, mine are basically, mine go way back. Well, not way, way back, but I don't really have anybody current, anybody working today doing mainstream work today. You might get a cover or something from one of the names on here, but it's not like I don't say anybody who's been doing anything from Image or Marvel or DC. Like, and I don't even know, like, some of the artists that I am aware of these days, whether it's Pepe or Jerome Peña or Kiz, anybody like that. Like, I already know what I've seen from them, and I really wouldn't call anybody that I could think of that's working today as underappreciated or rarely mentioned. So I kind of just stuck with the ones that I enjoyed growing up reading, whether they did a fill-in issue, whether they you know, only showed up like to do an annual or something like that. Like, they weren't necessarily they weren't drawing or writing a flagship book, and they didn't have a good run of like a couple of years. So like I thought of like someone like Luke McDonald. But yeah, he did Iron Man, which is where I knew him from. But he also did Justice League towards the end before the reboot, and he did Suicide Squad with Ostrander for a bunch of years. So it's not, I wouldn't, you know, you don't. I basically started taking names off when I know that they were on books that were bought that sold well, and they were on it for a while. So I started to just, instead of just making a list of names that I want to say out loud that hopefully people might think about and look for or remember, I wanted to actually stick it to people who may have worked on a run that wasn't, that may not be that fondly remembered, or would only show up here and there, would excite me, may not excite everybody, but I was just like, okay, cool. So it's like Jim Aparo's not on my list. He was on my initial list, but he's not on my top five. He's not on the five, because my man worked on like pretty much every Batman book for a bunch of years. Like, you couldn't not see a DC book that somewhere that Jim wasn't working on. So I really can't, while people may not think of him much these days, I can't really say, especially at the time, he was unappreciated.
I think that, yeah, our criteria are all different, because I think, like, being on a book regularly, like, to me, would contribute to my putting them on the list, because it's more about, like, do I think that their greatness is remembered or talked about in the way that it should be relative to what they actually were in their moments. So this would be interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's start with the old man. Let's Vince, who's your number five?
This is actually my, if I had to rank these in terms of the magnitude of their underappreciation, at least for this one in the States, this guy would be my number one.
Mm-hmm.
I want to call him the British Stan Lee, but I believe he actually wrote everything that bears his name. So I think calling him that would be that would be not nice. But I think it's ridiculous that this man isn't lauded in the States as much as I would like to see him appreciated. And it's Pat Mills.
Wow.
On my runner-up list.
Yeah, I mean, just go down the high marks, battle, action. Once you get to 2000 AD, it's a lock. Like, if you were crucial in the creation of 2000 AD and Judge Dredd and everything that came after, like, I think you've earned a level of respectability. You should be at least regarded for that effort. But then there's more. Like, not only did he set the template for Judge Dredd, Slain, right? Roebusters, ABC Warriors, Nemesis the Warlock. Like, stop there, but it keeps going on. Like, Third World War, Martial Law. Oh, my God. Toxic. Do you guys ever read Toxic? That thing was brilliant and disturbing and nasty and anarchic. Like, it's just a great magazine. And they did that Requiem Vampire Night. Like, Pat Mills seems to be this endless wellspring of really great concepts, wonderful writing, characters that go on and on and on and just immerse themselves in the zeitgeist. But over here, okay, Judge Dredd's a given, right? Maybe I would love to say ABC Warriors and Nemesis the Warlock, but are they though? In the States? I don't know. They have their fans, but if I had my druthers, people would follow Pat Mills around and in the States and just with red rose petals and just throw them at his feet because he's amazing. His work is just phenomenal. And then you say Pat Mills and you'd be like, Right? Like John Wagner, I think has a little more response in the States, right? But Pat Mills is the dude. He's the mastermind. He's the kingpin, and you know, great writer that just doesn't get his due, and it kills me.
Well, you know what? It's funny that you bring up Pat Mills tonight because our good buddy Tony Esmond and his mates had Pat Mills on their podcast this week.
How about that?
Episode 460 of the Awesome Comics Podcast.
It's almost as if I knew that.
Yeah, right? Now, to be fair, to people that aren't aware, Pat is a friend of Tony's, and he's been on the show many times. He's sort of like their Tony Fleece, I guess. So
imagine that. I love Tony, but I would trade him for Pat Mills in a friggin' second.
Nice. Well, yeah, like I said, I had him as a runner-up, so I'm certainly nodding my head to everything you were saying. Yeah. Daph, who's your number five?
Number five is actually blows everything that I said about my rules out of the water because he did actually he worked on flagships for both companies, but as far as you know anything since the 90s, I don't think I've really seen anything from or by Ron Frenz in a hot minute. And he took on Amazing Spider-Man after Romita Jr. When he was good, and then he did the Superman Annual, which went Burns first Superman Annual, and he worked for DC for a minute, inked by Sal Buscema. He worked on Thunderstrike with DeFalco, but yeah, he was, and I didn't. It took me a second to warm up to him after during Secret Wars because he was the artist when the black costume appeared in Amazing Spider-Man. So it wasn't a shocking difference, but I was so used to Romita Jr. that seeing Frenz's style, which was slightly different. Took me a second, but whether it's the expression on characters' faces, whether it's the clothes, especially around the ankles, on the pants of guys, there's something about Frenz's line I really like, and I do miss it, and I do believe he's going to be a hero, so I definitely have to make sure I shake his hand and thank him.
Well, hell yeah, you got to dap him up.
Yeah,
I think it's funny, but Alex Saviuk is actually more high profile than Ron Frenz these days.
He is, yes.
Yeah, I would agree and with that. They come from the same pot, right? Pretty much.
Although, I mean, Alex spent, I don't know if he still does, but he did the daily
Spidey strip. Well, that's what I'm talking about.
So,
right.
Yeah, so, which is, yeah. So, which proves your point.
No, I think it's one of those cases of time marching on. Yeah. I would love for Ron Frenz to draw a Marvel book these days, but I don't know if it would be seen as a Tom Scholey-esque, like, way back machine type deal where, oh, this is just a callback to the past. Like, It makes me sick because the guy would fit on almost anything.
Yeah, he's got a style that would work well because he's very. It's a very dynamic, action oriented style. But with Marvel doing these occasional throwback books, whether it's like, you could tie it into the X-Men cartoon, but they had one for Doctor Strange recently. Like every so often, like either Ralph Macchio or Nascenti or somebody, they'll pull someone back from the 80s or 90s and have them tell a tale from that era in Marvel, like the fucking armored Daredevil. They brought Chichester back for that. So if they wanted to do something, they could absolutely, like if they wanted to, like, you know, from the hidden vault, here's Thunderstrike, you could absolutely bring Ron back.
But I would like to see him on something that's unapologetic, like not a throwback to a particular period of Marvel publishing. I just put him on a book and if you know, no reservations. Just put Ron Frenz on a book. That's all you need to do.
Ageism is a real thing, right? In comics, it just is what it is.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate, too. I mean, Todd Knock dodged that bullet, right? Todd Knock is currently working. I mean,
Todd Knock's like my age, though. Like Ron Frenz has got to be in his 70s, right?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I think Knock's older than he is.
Nah. Okay, so my fifth pick is number five because they are still a working modern artist, whereas the others are older school, so figured he should be fifth. And it's someone that we've talked about plenty. I know that we're all big fans of his work, but I think that we are way more complimentary of this dude than the average comic like ether seems to ever be, and that's Stuart Immonen. I think that the dude is, you know, one of the five best superhero artists of his generation, and I don't think many people view him that way. And I think part of the problem is that for as much as we appreciate his work, he's really never had a seminal run. Like, sure, Next Wave joking aside, like especially because that was a different style, but he really hasn't. You know, he's worked on a ton of books, he's worked on most of the big characters. But he's never really had like a meaty run that you just identify with him and like that he put a stamp on a book. And I think that hurts him. And then the other thing is that, you know, we know a lot of artists, and Immonen is the artist that if you pull other artists at Artist Alley, who the best modern comic artist is, that like half of them say Immonen. Like even when you like it's a ridiculous number of them believe that Stuart Immonen is the best artist in business. And I know Scotty Young is of that mind for, you know, but my pick is Stuart.
He has you're right. He was there at the start of Bendis's All New X-Men when he brought that team to the future to the present, and he spent some time drawing Amazing Spider-Man when Slott was writing it. But as far as like a nice long run that you could say, I mean, yeah, aside from Next Wave, where you could say that he was a co-creator or just took over and made the book his own. Yeah, it's unfortunate.
That when Jason was saying that he never clicked on a long high profile run, I thought the Bendis X-Men revival was going to be that book.
Yeah.
When it was coming out, because I was like, in my opinion, he was, I don't want to beat that horse, but I think he was the only reason to read that book. The book looked phenomenal. It was far away the best looking book on the stands at the time. And I say that about a lot of his books, because like many of our artist friends, I think Immonen is just a juggernaut. But yeah, I would love to see him on a book that really grabs everybody's attention and shows them what the guy's capable of.
Well, I mean, unless he changes his mind, he's retired from Big Two Comics. So
right, but he did that IDW, not IDW. He did that Ad House thing recently.
Yeah, he's doing. That's what I'm saying. He's doing his own stuff now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's a force to be reckoned with, man.
He is, and I'm sure your number four pick is as well.
Oh, yeah. This is the one that I scratch my head over, that I don't understand why this guy isn't widely regarded, because especially in terms of horror art, there's not too many guys better. I'll tell you everything he did, and then you tell me his name. He did a good amount of Warren work. Drew the first Vampirella story. A bunch of interior stories and a lot of cover work. He did tons of stuff for Skywald. Psycho, Nightmare, Scream, The Heap. He did, when Skywald was doing four-color comics, he did a good amount of Westerns. He's many Lovecraft-inspired or themed paintings. He was on Ghost Rider, Werewolf by Night. He did the Man-Thing story in Marvel Comics Presents. A bunch of really great strips for the Marvel Black and White magazines. Particularly, there was a future story. What was it called? The Future History Chronicles that appeared in Marvel's Planet of the Apes magazines. He did House of Mystery and Secrets at DC. He drew Star Trek for DC. Marvel Premiere 50 with Alice Cooper. Stacks and stacks and stacks of pages for Charlton. Many Ghosts of Dr. Graves, Midnight Tales, Creepy Things. He was the guy that did the cover, that glorious image that we all lovingly peered at for days and days and days when they put that ad in the Charlton books for the comic book guide for the artist, writer, and letterer. He was really active in the fan press, too. He did a good amount of work for Rockets Blast and the Comic Collector. And he even did porno comics for Fantagraphics Eros imprint. Who this is, David knows.
I have a very good feeling, a very good idea. I know who it is.
Say it, say it.
Star Trek is what's...
Right, I knew that you would get that.
That's what I honed in on, which made me think of Ricardo Villagran.
No, it's Tom Sutton.
See, and I knew.
Yeah.
Because when I told you that Villagran inked Sutton on Star Trek, you seemed completely gobsmacked by that, which is why I was like, wait, is he talking about? Because I didn't know Sutton had the connection to Vampirella.
Yeah, he drew the first story.
There we go. So I learned something today.
Yeah, Trina Robbins designed the costume and Tom illustrated the first story. And it sucks because you would think that, okay, this is the first Vampirella story. This is going to set the template. No, it did not. It changed slowly. But once Gonzalez got on the book, it was done. Like, he was the face of Vampirella for a long time. But yeah, I mean, Sutton's work is incredible and disturbing, and even when you could tell a good artist when their work looks great, even printed like shit, like Charlton books, Sutton stands out even in the Charlton stuff. Like, he's just an amazing, amazing talent. Nobody draws madness like Tom Sutton. Characters just losing their shit, and it just, you could feel it through the eyes and the facial expressions and the way he just, that ragged just incision of a line that Sutton made. I absolutely adore his work, and it's nuts because whenever people start going on about horror artists, it's always the same guys, Bernie Wrightson, you know, down the list. And Sutton will get mentioned, but not as quickly as I would like. Like, he should be up there at the top. And right. Yeah, it's just not a whole lot of talk of Tom Sutton. I actually felt bad when he was doing the porno comics for under the name Dementia, like, because you could tell who it was, Tom Sutton. But I mean, they're foul, foul comics. They're really nasty.
And I'm intrigued. I didn't know he died in 2002.
Yeah, well, he had problems with substances, alcohol and stuff,
he was a whopping 65 years old.
Yeah, gone too soon.
Yep.
There, if a Tom Sutton book comes across my field of vision and I don't have it, it's not going to be in the box for long. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I miss his work. He was on my running initial list, but yeah, that's great. Now,
it was nice that our buddy Craig Yeo scooped up a bunch of key Sutton works and published it in that the horror comics anthology series for IDW that he was doing for a bunch of years. There's a Tom Sutton volume, and it's really great. I think it's called Tom Sutton's Creepy Things or something like that. Yeah, I would never part with that. Yeah. There's another book on this list that I would never part with. And we're getting to it, so.
But first, let's get to Dabs number four.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Sort of kind of another exception because looking at, mostly he's worked for DC. He's done some work for the indies and a little few things here and there for Marvel. But I will check out anything he's drawing, regardless of who's writing it, because I am such a fan of this man's work, whether he's drawing Superboy, whether he's drawing the Teen Titans, whether he's drawing... the only thing I haven't really... I never got around to reading his Shore Thunderbolts run, but I am a huge fan of Tom Grummett.
Yeah, me too.
And anything he wants to draw, I am there to check out.
The Thunderbolts run is really good.
Is that like only like 9-10 issues or something, or was he on
one of them? I want to say 10 issues, 9 issues, okay. Yeah, around there. But it looks so good. Oh my god! I needless to say, I think it's the best Thunderbolts ever looked. Baron Zemo is just amazing.
Sure.
Yeah. What was that?
I said I enjoyed this run for sure on Thunderbolts, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, at the risk of being perceived as misogynistic, Grummett draws incredible women.
He really does. The Maxima. Yeah.
Incredible. Sure. Knockout.
Knockout.
Shut up. Yeah.
Jake.
Yeah, we're done.
Nice. All right. So my number four, I'm going the writer route. I think this man... Probably partially because I think he's relatively media shy from what I can gather. Probably hurts him in today's day and age, but I think he should be talked about among the greatest of this era. And like certainly when people talk about like a Mark Waid, like this guy should be up or even above him, I think, when you talk about the work that he's done. And he's not. I think he's largely forgotten, especially people like 30 and under, and it baffles me. And that is Kurt Busiek. You all know I love the Avengers, and I would argue there's a case to be made that he's the best Avengers writer ever. And certainly if you don't want to go there, and that's okay, it's a debate, like I said, he did absolutely have a long, fantastic run on the Avengers, of course, a lot of it with George Perez. And on top of that, he wrote, which, you know, we've talked about this many times over the years, Avengers Forever, which I think is the best Avengers story of all time. He, of course, JLA Avengers. He wrote Thunderbolts, which is he's talking about Thunderbolts. And of course, then he's been doing Astro City for like what, the last, I don't know, 20 That's, years now.
And, well, this is kismet, because if you see the new previews catalog. Mm-hmm. Busiek has a brand spanking new superhero team book coming out from Image.
Get out of here. That's lit. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So I think the guy is just an all time great writer for superheroes. And, you know, I know that Astro City probably never got the readership if he stayed doing, you know, like mainstream, like 616 or mainstream DC, but it's so good. I mean, it's so freaking good. And I just think, and it is still superhero, right? It's like one of the few long running independent books that also is a Cape book that survived. And I don't know, man, like I just think the guy deserves all the flowers. And I feel like if you were to like poll people, he's never someone that like comes up, like people will say Bendis first, they'll put like Wade over it or Rucka. And I just think that's like criminal.
Yeah, it's baffling. Yeah. And you forgot Aerosmith too. Great book.
Yeah. No, I didn't. Yeah,
you're right. I mean, it's niche, but it's still a very good book. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. Wednesday Comics.
Yep. Mm-hmm. He's crazy good.
For sure.
Yep.
Number three, Vince.
Number three. I told Dap there's an inker on my list, and that's kind of part of where the criminally underrated comes in, because everybody knows this guy as the embellisher of choice for Alan Davis and Brian Hitch. I'm talking about Paul Neary.
That's it. I'm good at that.
But now I think his inking skills are very well recognized in the industry. Unfortunately, Paul passed this year. So pour one out for Paul. But what is overlooked is his illustration ability, because mm-hmm. Paul did what I consider one of the best serials from Erie magazine, and that is the Hunter series. Have you ever read that? It is absolutely incredible. It's a tour de force, and I wanted to reacquaint myself with it as I was making my list. So I pulled the volume off the shelf. That's one of the books that I never part with. Dark Horse published, while they were publishing the Erie Archives and the Creepy Archives, they would spotlight certain creators. There's a Bernie Wrightson spotlight book. There's a Corbin. There's an El Cid. But there's also a Hunter volume that goes for stupid amounts of money now. It's just ridiculous. For like, it was $20, I think, when it came out hardcover. It's like $250 if you find a mint one. It's just crazy. But I would say it's worth the money, because as I was reacquainting myself with it, that wind and rain technique that Frank Miller kind of put his thumbprint on for Sin City and, you know, other works where, you know, it's just blobs of white and, you know, spackling and spraying off solid surfaces. Neary did that back in the 70s in the Hunter series. It's just like, I'm not saying that he originated the technique, but if you're going through the timeline, he did it before Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's just the drawing in this Hunter strip is absolutely astounding. The page layouts, the typography, like everything is just gorgeous. And it's a disturbing story. And Hunter went on through a number of incarnations. There was a Hunter, there was a Hunter 2. I think there was three different Hunters, and they're all in that volume. But it's just, it's one of my favorite stories of all time. I love this work. And it's like, that's not all Paul Neary did. He's like, had stuff in 2000 AD. He did Warrior with Dez Skin. He was the editor of Marvel UK for a while. Like, we wouldn't have Death's Head and all those books without the involvement of Paul Neary. So I love Paul Neary's work. I mean, I like his inking a lot. He certainly makes Alan Davis look the best he's ever looked. But I love his illustrated stuff that he, you know, plotted and composed and drew it. I just love it. It's just amazing. Yeah, and again, he draws good women.
He does. I first became aware of Paul when he was penciling Captain America. And this was around the Scourge era. And then I noticed he was inking Alan on Excalibur, and I was like, holy shit. And looks great. And then he spent a lot of time inking Brian Hitch too, because he's right. The inker of the Ultimates. I agree with you that Paul is amazing on Alan Davis. I think he probably stays true to Alan's line more than the person I consider my favorite pairing, which is Mark Farmer, because I just love the way he adds the curves to the lines. But Paul is no joke. That's a great pick.
Well, if you put the an Alan Davis inked image or page next to an Alan Davis ink or a Paul Neary inked Brian Hitch page, he altered his approach. Based on the style of the penciler.
Yes.
Like the inking on Hitch. Like the inking on Hitch looks nothing like the inking on Davis. It's like this guy's a Swiss Army knife.
He's pretty much like Al Milgrom, who would just kind of stay true to not just trace it, but there aren't many inkers that will actually let so much of the penciler's line come through. They're there to just kind of help that bring it to the page. You don't, not everybody can be Scott Williams or Klaus, or you just have some inkers that you just know, regardless of Terry Austin, you just know whether he's inking Marshall Rogers or John Byrne, you kind of know it's Terry Austin. So there are inkers who definitely leave their mark but occasionally you'll get the Pauls, the Allens, the Doug Hazelwoods, things like that, where they just like let the penciler do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, I kind of wish Al Milgram didn't let Chaykin's pencils come through on that Micronauts run, because
I was wondering if I was going to catch heat for having that view, but I'm glad I didn't. Yeah,
no, let's welcome to Dookie City.
But, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Speaking of things that aren't Dookie, who's your number three, Dan?
My number three is somebody who I wish was still drawing comics, but he left in the he kind of dipped out in probably the early 90s. And worked on the special effects concept art and character design, storyboards, things like that. But I, you know, in the 80s, if I was never upset if it was a fill-in issue by Kerry Gamble. And he did more work, I think, for Marvel than he did. I mean, I know for DC, he would do a fill-in here and there, and he worked on the Power Girl cover, the miniseries. He did the covers for that. He would do some pieces here and there, filling on an issue of Superman one a little bit. But I mean, he of course drew most of the Fallen Angels miniseries, limited series for Marvel. Did a lot of Marvel team up, some Marvel fanfare, did some Star Wars work. So he was mostly I liken him to, like, he was the utility player, is if because he did a there was an issue of Fantastic Four where he did the bulk of the issue. Byrne basically just did the opening and closing page, and the bulk of the issue was Kerry. So he was somebody who I just felt that, I mean, there may still be some inventory stories in a drawer somewhere, but if somebody was running late, I just felt that they get Kerry to come in, draw an issue, and everything was back on track. But yeah, it's his is a name that I can go a long, long time without anybody ever saying it. So he definitely does not get the recognition I think he deserves.
Yeah, that's a good one, because I haven't thought of the dude in a long fucking
time. Yep.
For sure. No. It also speaks to how we all take different approaches, though, because my number three is much better known.
I'm sure.
And it's, I mean, I'm curious to see Vince's reaction, but I went with Steve Gerber as my number three pick, Vince.
I almost had him on my list.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I mean, obviously, he's gotten plenty of flowers from us and many of our listeners. You adore him. He's one of your all-time favorite writers. And I just, for me, you know, we've been doing a lot more rereading of that classic stuff. And I know I talked about it specifically when I read the Howard Omnibus a month or two back. But, like, his writing stands the test of time in a way that no other writer of that generation does. There was a we all know what it's like to read a comic from that era, right? And you get the expository dialogue and the ham-fisted adjectives, and just, it was just the way people wrote comics, you know, maybe even if they didn't speak that way. But Gerber's comics are so, they sound like people having conversations, but they're not just random conversations. They're witty and funny and intelligent, and I just think the guy, just in terms of, like, the actual art of crafting dialogue and a narrative in a comic, there are few that are ever his peer, and I just don't think he gets those kinds of flowers because people know him as, oh, that's right, he's the funny guy that used to write Howard the Duck and Man-Thing, right? Like, that's the, and I think that's just so, like, it's cool that he gets recognition in that box, but, like, to me, he should get a much bigger box of recognition. Like, he should be viewed much more broadly as, like, one of the best to ever do it. So yeah,
totally agree. Totally. But I had to ask myself, am I putting him on the list because I love him, or is he really that underappreciated? And I didn't put him on because I couldn't, I can't take a subjective or an objective view on Gerber. Like, I think he is one of the greatest writers of all time. Subversive as hell, infused the work with far more substance than it actually needed, and commentary on social change, well, a whole bunch of stuff, right? And I just can't look at it from a clinical viewpoint and say, well, is Gerber really unappreciated? Not by me. So I just took him off the list for that reason. I didn't want to struggle with my conscience on that
point. All right. There you go.
Yeah.
Not putable.
Well, you're smart.
All right. Tell us who your silver medalist is.
Well, these are in no particular order.
Okay.
Except for Pat. My next guy, we all know him. We're all enamored with his work. And I think if you're more attuned to the horror aspect or the genre, and you have an appreciation for EC Comics and the ilk, I think you know Steve Mannion. But I would love to see Steve Mannion get the accolades he deserves, because I think he's one of the best illustrators out there. And I don't know why he's not on. I mean, I know why, because he's doing his creator stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I would love to see him just click with a high profile book and everybody recognize, like, wow, this guy is super talented. Like, everything. He has one foot in the past and another in contemporary comics. He's just I think he's a journeyman. I think he can do everything and do it well. Kind of like, maybe I shouldn't say this, but like a young Joe Kubert. Like, he seems to be able to draw anything, draw it well. He's adept at sequentials. He can pull you into the narrative, and he makes your eyes happy. Equally proficient with the grotesque and the glorious. Like, many of the focal points of his work have been women, because he does that really, really well. He's also great with monsters and zombies and dinosaurs and weapons of war and atmosphere. Like, the guy is incredible. Why is he not lauded? It's just crazy.
I agree. That's a great pick. And we'll see him at Charlotte.
Yes, oh, that's one.
Oh, no, we won't, actually.
Why?
No, he's not there this year. I forgot. I assume because he's still recovering from his issues he had.
Oh, well.
But yeah, but he's we'll see him probably next year. He's there almost every year, so.
Yes, and it's a treat.
Indeed.
Yep. And he's a little weird, which I love.
Very weird. Yeah.
Yes, that he has a very unique personality, and I think that's a plus when making art.
And he's not very big fan of the Star Wars.
Okay, I didn't know that.
That's a joke. He our buddy Cliff, at our urging,
yeah,
went to Steve to get a jam piece a few years ago and asked him to do Princess Leia. And let's just say it's, you know, nobody bets 1,000. We'll say it that way.
Wow.
And it was an outfit that Leia was in, like, for maybe 20 minutes in one of the movies. So it's not like it's not like an iconic image of Leia either.
Oh, it's not a slave girl.
No, it's not. True. Which, you know, you would think that I
would go with that.
That's who Cliff was angling for, but yeah, that's not where Steve was headed.
I think it was like the Hoth, right? The
Hoth. Yeah, it was from her winter outfit from the beginning.
That's weird.
It's weird. Really weird. And her pose is just like she's just standing there. It's almost like she's holding a cup of coffee, looking at like someone, like she's a soccer mom
play a game. I always tell my students, if you're going to do a character piece, I don't want to see any characters standing around waiting for a bus. Like, that's freaking, mm-hmm. That's boring.
Yeah. That's kind of what it was, if I remember right.
And you know what? Yeah. Who else I would add to this? Just on the back of Steve Mannion, an artist of the same stripe, Bud Root.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah. Not to take any spotlight away from Steve, but Bud's another guy that I just like, why? Mm-hmm. Why isn't he bigger?
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Awesome. Take it away.
This is a twofer because they're a duo that I can never separate, even though one of them did do some solo work for a little while, because they only kind of worked together for like maybe 10 years or so.
I know who it is.
You do know who they are.
Is.
They basically, I mean, when you talk about, we were just talking about inkers who can either kind of blend in with the penciler or kind of make the work their own and mm-hmm. either soften or enhance when they're embellishing. But Ian Akin and Brian Garvey do some amazing work together, and they, whether it's Steve Ditko, whether it's Sal Buscema, whether it's Luke McDonald, like they can work with everyone, and they're not so overpowering where you think you're buying an Akin and Garvey book, regardless of who drew the layouts. They do, no matter who's drawing it, you can still see who drew it, who put the initial lines down. But when it comes time for them to add that depth, to add those shadows, to just completely, they're who I think of when I think of the word embellishing. Everybody, we got a ton of anchors in the industry. We're used to, but now, like when it comes to these two dudes, they kind of like elevate it to a whole different art form.
They certainly slicked up Sal. Like, yes, Sal never looked that polished.
Right.
And I think it was an asset. I think they did Sal a solid.
Especially in that era of ROM, because it was such a dark and tense and thriller filled time for that book. So the darks really kind of, the shadows really, especially with the Dire Wraiths, man, they made the Dire Wraiths look way more sinister than they did 100. In those early issues.
Yeah, totally agree. And, as a follower of Sal, his next project, which did not have Akin and Garvey, I was like, something's missing. It's good. It's Sal. So you're getting a level that not many others bring, but there's a piece of this puzzle that is missing. And I realized it was Akin and Garvey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love their work.
Yep. Excellent pick. My number two is the man who started this conversation. I could not have him on the list. Bill Mantlow.
This guy
fucking is like, I mean, think about the year that we're just talking about, how this is the, like, Marvel's putting all this stuff like ROM, Micronauts, fucking Hulk, Transformers, Rocket Raccoon, and Guardians. Like, dude was all over it. And like, these are like if you're of a certain age, this stuff is like the most beloved stuff. It's like the stuff that made you a comics fan lifelong. And then, you know, as with all of these people, there's a story to tell. And I think for Bill, probably what happened is, you know, a lot of these legends either stuck around or were doing the con scene, right? And so they're kind of like still in the conversation. But as we know, Bill basically got burnt out with comics and became a lawyer. Actually went and became a lawyer. He was a practicing lawyer for a bunch of years. And then, unfortunately, in 1992, was a victim of a hit and run that basically put him into severe brain trauma for the rest of his life. And he's still alive. And, you know, and he's been dealing with that. His family has been dealing with that for many decades. I mean, I guess a little bit of a bright spot, which we probably talked about on the show when it happened. But Marvel did come to an agreement with him with the Guardian stuff and some other stuff. I forget what else, but it was. But and basically said, put it up so that, like, you know, paid him a lot of money. And I know his brother at the time had said that, like, you know, they'll never have to worry about being able to afford, you know, the long-term care that Bill needs, which is all good. You know, that's all good news, but certainly tragic that the man in his prime of his life was obviously largely, you know, taken out of his life. But that should never, that unfortunately, I think it has, but it shouldn't detract from what an incredible storyteller and just a guy who clearly was like the super utility man, like if in a baseball analogy, like, you know, these were things I would imagine, at least ROM and Micronauts weren't like, you know, the projects that everyone was fighting and pushing each other to write, because obviously they were licensed projects and they weren't anything until they made it into something, right? So like they had no frame. It wasn't like there was any nostalgic pull or feeling of importance, but he, you know, he took on the tasks and he didn't just like do it at launch. He wrote fucking years and years of these stories, you know? And I think as we're rediscovering, and maybe he'll be more appreciated now that all these Omnibus are hitting the stands, but like, you know, a lot of his stuff was super fun, you know, super, super fun and just action packed. And I think he really was in the zeitgeist of the moment of the kind of thing that people wanted to read in a superhero comic. And so,
I would call that, aside from my introduction to Amazing Spider-Man, the bronze Mantlo era, which overlapped a little bit of the Gerber stuff. is probably my favorite, all-time favorite Marvel era.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guy was just creative as hell.
He really was.
And we'll talk about it a lot more next episode.
The, yeah, I know. He pretty much was. I know we'll sometimes we had those conversations when you were younger. Like Marvel had Byrne, DC had Perez, and Mantlo was always Marvel for me. And I would, I'd put him up with any of the writers at DC at the time who were just who were nonstop putting out books, whether it be Marv Wolfman, whether it would be Schwartz, anybody who was writing long term. Mantlo was, and it just his Marvel credits are just insane. I don't think there's a character at Marvel that he didn't touch in some way, shape, or form. He may not have taken on like the Amazing Spider-Man series, but he definitely wrote stories that featured Spider-Man. And he wrote Amazing Annual. He wrote a couple of issues here and there. But I mean, Alpha Flight, Hulk, we'll do in the swap with Byrne.
Yeah, I blame Byrne. I blame John.
Well, I know John blames Mantlo for screwing up Puck, but Bill is just I love his work, always have. It made watching Guardians of the Galaxy in the theater that much bittersweet, because I knew that they had arranged to have a screening so he could see it at the hospital. And of course, obviously they set him up with credits for Rocket Raccoons. So like Jason says, got nothing to worry about. But it hurts. I mean, if he just walked away and that was it, and he's enjoying life and doing what he wants to do. But yeah, I mean, it's at least he left just this massive body of work that now. You used to have to, for some of the work, you'd have to just look in the back issue bins and hope to score some of it. Now, at least we've got these omnibus coming out, so that's helpful. But I mean, yeah, you can, man, 80s and Marvel, it was like, it was Mantlo. That was,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we could say Starlin and Gerber, you have a few others here and there, but I mean, for the most part, it was, they needed something written. They gave it to Bill. Oh, man.
Yeah, he was a powerhouse, definitely. Yep. So are we on our number five now?
Mine's my number one. Yeah, we started.
Right, this is our fifth one.
Yeah. Yes.
Is Jason still here? Did he bug out?
Thought I saw him light up. He's still here. He's muted.
Yes, sorry, I was on mute. My Chance pushed his head into the door and I had to scoot him out so that he wasn't.
Little boy.
Yeah.
My last one is without question the best illustrator on my list. He was one of the best illustrators of during the time he was working. He could hold a candle to anyone. He's the co-creator of Man-Thing. Illustrated his first appearance in Savage Tales number 1. If you don't know his name now, you will when I say this. He did Charlton's Space 1999 magazine. Did the Red Circle stuff for Archie. Worked in Heavy Metal. Illustrated the... it's a masterpiece. It's called the Illustrated Roger Zelazny. I've never been able to pronounce his last name. Zelazny. He worked in National Lampoon. Did a ton of amazing movie posters. The Powerline Critical Mass stuff for Epic. He did all of the Perry Rhodan paperback covers. He's worked at Warren, Skywall, DC. There's a gorgeous Zatanna one-shot that he did. He was also a comic strip artist. Worked on Rip Kirby, Buck Rogers, Tarzan. The guy's a giant. Gray Morrow.
Mm-hmm. He was on my alternates, yeah.
Incredible illustrator.
Yeah, big time.
I liken him to there was like a trio of guys back in the day that I perceived that their work contained something that I didn't see in many others, and that was Gray Morrow, Pat Boyette, and Alex Toth. These guys just stood out as being very different, but in a more craftsman-like style. Like they had a line that was unlike the standard or the average line, where they drew like seasoned illustrators, and they could compose, and their lettering was phenomenal. Their figure work was just amazing. They had a facility with mood and tone. Like, I don't think there's anybody. Well, I shouldn't say that. There's not many that can go shoulder to shoulder with Gray Morrow.
Mm-hmm. Imprint.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the imprint was the first Man Thing story. That just sunk the hooks in me, and I was like, all right, I'll follow this guy.
Oh, that is a good one. Oh, my number one still hurts, because I don't know what else we would have gotten from him had he not died in 1996 at the age of 30. He didn't have a ton of work during his career, his very short-lived career, but he did work on some pretty fun books for DC, like Batman Animated Series, did some Secret Origins, did some work for Impact Comics, like The Fly, which was fun, fit his style. I loved the work he did on El Diablo. I'm hoping one of these years maybe DC will just put out a trade of that. But Mike Porobic was just somebody, I love his style. It was cartoony, it was vibrant, it was lively. He did some great figure work. I really, really was big fan of his line, and I was really hoping that we'd get that he'd make his way up to one of the bigger books. Not necessarily, didn't have to be a team book, didn't have to be anything major. I wouldn't have mind seeing him on Superman for a bit, but obviously it wasn't meant to be. But yeah, my number one underappreciated artist is Mike Probick.
All right, respect. Well, my number one is substantially better known than that. But I still think that for me it was like the first name I thought of when we agreed to do this, and this is from a historical perspective, and that's Gardner Fox. I think Gardner Fox, it's insane to me that he isn't, like, when people talk about their Rushmores and they throw out names like Stan Lee, that they don't bring up Gardner Fox. Like, I don't know whose cereal he pissed in the annals of comics history, that he is somehow cast aside. Like, he's not one of the absolute, like, foundational fathers of superhero comics. Like, dude created The Flash. He created Sandman. He created Hawkman, Starman. He created the fucking JSA, and he fucking created the Justice League. Like, are you kidding me? But wait, there's more. He is the guy who created the idea of there being a multiverse in the Big Two. Like, it's crazy. And on top of that, it wasn't like dude was just getting in for these big ideas. He is, to this day, the second most prolific person in DC Comics history in terms of output. So, like, it's just, I don't, like, he is never mentioned when people have conversations about, like, the most important people in superhero comics history. Like, he always gets trumped by other people from DC, and obviously, like, the Stan and Jack, which is fine. I mean, that's, but like, I don't understand it. Like, why doesn't Gardner Fox get his flowers? He is, like, the foundational creator of all the things that, like, are valuable in the DC universe now, outside of Batman and Superman, like, specifically.
Ain't that wrong?
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a historian. Why do you think that Gardner Fox doesn't get the props that he deserves?
I'm not entirely sure. Maybe because the characters and groups he instigated, while very important, aren't really big names in the DC universe. Like Justice League, okay, that's pretty much the top. But, you know, just to...
Is it Flash? Flash isn't...
I don't think so. Not anymore.
Their second to last giant studio movie was The Flash.
Right.
The longest running TV show.
Is The Flash on the level? Oh, no, I'm not. I don't want to undercut the guy's accomplishments because, significant. But I just think he played in corners of the DCU that weren't giant sellers. Right? Maybe not. Maybe they were at the time, but now they've faded for whatever reason. Like JSA, it's very hard to get that book to click.
I hear you, but here's the thing I counter with. A guy that we all adore, especially because we're more, at least back when we were younger, we're Marvel people, Roy Thomas. You know I love Roy, but look at the list of the people, of the characters that Roy created. It pales in comparison to Flash, Sandman, Hawkman, Starman, the Justice League, and the multiverse. Like Roy was an incredible keeper of the flame. He was not someone who brought a tremendous amount of at least stuff that lasted the test of time in terms of creative output. So, if we're saying all Gardner Fox would do is create the Flash and the Hawkman, it's like they're like tentpole members of the Justice League, and Flash in particular has like an ongoing book at all times, always. But like, what do we give Roy Thomas credit for, right? Like, Roy comes up in these conversations more than Gardner Fox. True. And I understand it's a generational thing, because Gardner Fox was 30 years before Roy Thomas. But, like, just if we're actually talking about, like, having their fingerprints as an architect of what the current DC or Marvel Universe is, there's no question Gardner Fox had a much bigger impact on the DC Universe than Roy or many others, like, or Roger Stern. Like, I love those guys. They're, like, personally speaking, Roy Thomas's work means more to me than Gardner Fox's work. But like, that's not what I'm coming at from this. I'm just like,
right. I get it.
I just don't get why he's not considered in the pantheon of like the all-time most important superhero architects. It just doesn't, it baffles me.
Roy also had the benefit of the Mighty Marvel marketing mouthpiece behind him.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure.
So, I mean, it was 30 years removed, and the advertising and the championing of the medium was nowhere near what it was in the past, right? Roy had the benefit of all the college kids plugging into Marvel Comics. He had the benefit of Stan being the guy that was like waving the flag. These things are great. DC never really advertised all that much. They never really took to the airwaves, and I think Marvel's approach was very different in the fact that they had to create a scene, whereas DC was always the standby. Like, it was DC Comics. They've been doing it for a long time. They continued to do it. And when Marvel came in, it was like a lightning bolt. Like, whoa, we either need to change the way we make and sell these things, or stop doing it. And DC did change, but I think the change was very slow coming. It took until Crisis for them to actually start, you know, trumpeting the merits of their books and their creators. But I don't know. It's a strange question. I don't know how to answer it. Why isn't Gardner Fox more appreciated? I don't know. Maybe because of the period in which he created.
That's where I'm leaning. I think because people just don't want to. I mean, we're always harping on DC with either not coming up with anything new, or always going back to the well, or coming up with a new imprint when you've got all these legacy characters that you could just play with already. But I think when you think of Gardner Fox or the Showcase number 4 or just anything like that, it just sounds like some just from such a time long ago, and that's no excuse. I mean, it's history. I can embrace it. He wrote some fun stories, and like, I mean, the resume that Jason just ran down. I mean, thanks to him, we got the multiverse. We had the every year the JSA and the JLA would team up to fight for Degaton and Vandal Savage or whatever. So it's just you've got, I know.
Yay. Let's fight the caveman.
I'm not one to talk because I love that shit. But yeah, I think anybody who's been reading comics since Identity Disc, they're not going to know who the hell he is.
And I also think that DC didn't approach the reprinting of that material in a attractive way. Like, I think the DC Archive books are, by and large, ugly-looking books.
The Essential? Oh, the Showcase?
No, the Archives. The heavy, the hardcovers with the... just the trade dress on those things. It just looks old-timey. And I think if they took a more contemporary approach, like, you look at the Marvel Masterworks and with the frame and stuff, they are semi-dated now, but they didn't, I don't think DC took the steps to create some kind of demand for these books like Marvel did. And I don't know, maybe now if there was a career-wide Gardner Fox, reprint program at DC, who knows, maybe they would click. I don't know. I don't know. It's a mystery, Jason.
A grand mystery, Vince.
It is. It's crazy.
And there's but like 15.
What's not a mystery is the place to go for cheap graphic novels, omnibus, trade paperbacks, manga. Where do you go? Well, there's only one place. CheapGraphicNovels.com. CheapGraphicNovels.com have all that stuff and more at a fraction of the price printed on the back. And here's the secret I teased at the beginning of the episode. Go to CheapGraphicNovels.com. Just buy something. Spend some money, right? Bolster the economy. And you're going to receive an email confirmation from said order. And you're going to respond to that email confirmation saying, 11 o'clock comics sent me. And Max is going to give you free shipping on your next order. And that's when you buy the omnibus editions. You buy a crate of them or a skid. Buy a skid of omnibus editions. Have them delivered to your home for free.
Sounds like Brian Newbery.
CheapGraphicNovels.com.
For real.
Yes, it does. And please look at our Patreon page, patreon.com/11oclockcomics. New stuff every day. The Slack is jumping, as it always is. A bunch of relatively like-minded individuals talking about everything under the sun, comics, movies, TV, books, original art, how you doing lately, health things, sports things. It's amazing. Games, role-playing games, we talk about those too. Video games, like everything under the sun. It's talked about on our Slack. And there's one way you can get in there and become a patron and join the family and we'll love you forever. We have a new patron.
I was going to say we've had some returning patrons. It's
why don't you give them a shout?
We'll give them a four. Like we don't do that because like we don't want to leave anybody out. Like so.
She want to compile a list.
If I got one or two people off that I remember, then someone else might be like, well, "What about me?" I just
right. You'll be revealed as the bad guy. In your travels, I don't think I have to coax anybody into reading this, but just in case I do, I want you to get out there and pick up One Piece, Ace's Story, the manga, Volume 1. Storyboards by Ryo Ishiyama, created by Ichiro Oda, based on One Piece, Ace's Story by Sho Hinata and Tetsuya Hamazaki. The real joy here is that this volume is illustrated by Boichi. And it is absolutely amazing. It's astounding. The dude's a master. I love his style. It is the story of Luffy's brother, Portgas D. Ace, a.k.a. Firefist Ace. And his formation of his little Spade Pirates group. He goes after Blackbeard in this book. It's a formative story where he's coming up. If you have seen the Netflix series, One Piece, a lot of the incidents and characters from that are going to be very familiar to you because they appear in this. There's even a scene cut from, I think it was maybe the last episode or the second last episode, Zolo's unfortunate fight that left him deciding that he will never lose again. Remember that fight? That's illustrated in this book, and it's a it's magnificent. Yeah, it's just get it.
It's like One Piece and your and Boichi, but together. That's like it's like peanut butter and chocolate for you.
Right. Well, of course, Boichi was the illustrator of Dr. Stone, which has since finished, and that series is just jaw-dropping. Boichi's another one of those dudes that seems to be able to draw everything in a very idiosyncratic, pleasing, very sculpted style. It's just eye candy. It really is. So if you ever want to see Nami illustrated by Boichi, I think this is the book you got to get because, yeah, it's sexy as hell. She's not in it for very long, maybe a couple of panels, because it's not really a story about the Straw Hat Pirates. It's more Ace's group. But I don't think this is going to go on forever. Maybe 2-3 volumes. I don't know. But you should get it because the chance to just see Boichi draw or play around in the One Piece universe is just, we don't know how good we're having it right now. So, yes. The title again is One Piece, Ace's Story, the manga, volume 1. It's cheap. It's like $9. Let me see what. Yeah, it's less. The list price is $11.95, but you know you're not going to pay that elsewhere. So just get it. There's a fold out in it. Yep.
In your travels, this published by Humanoids. It is written by Jerry Frison, art by Roberto Zaghi. It is called Starcrossed, and it's not necessarily a it's a familiar tale about humans going out in space as first contact, and what it's like to meet these extraterrestrials, but things aren't exactly how they appear. The art is very similar to, very reminiscent of all the other translated European books from Humanoids. Art's fine. The characters are great. Some of the women are extremely attractive. Even some of the aliens are attractive. The main character, Danko Orton, he's got some baggage. He doesn't talk about his past life. We do get some flashbacks about where he came from and the type of family he's from, and that mentality that he tried to escape, that bigotry is still present even with him in space, not from the aliens, but from the other specialists and scientists on the ship with him. So some of it is very, it's very easy to recognize based on the current state of the world, but it's I really, really like the art style. The science fiction aspect of it is what was speaking to me. It's there are some twists and turns that some that I wasn't expecting, but overall I was very pleasantly surprised with this. Every once in a while I'll come across not necessarily an offering from Humanoids, but definitely something that looks like it's in my wheelhouse, up my alley. But after a few pages, it's either missing the mark, it lost the plot, whatever. It goes astray and loses my interest. But between between the writing and the art and interspecies sex, this one kind of kept me entertained throughout. So yeah, if you can find it, if you can track it down, it's fairly new. It shouldn't be that difficult. I remember seeing it in previews when I was looking at the first few pages of it. But yeah, Starcrossed by Humanoids, published by Humanoids.
Right on, right on. It is a glorious time to be alive if you are a science fiction comic fan, because My Inner Travels, like Daps, is science fiction comics, and it's three for you for the price of one, because we've talked about all these books relatively recently, so more of an In Your Travels reminder that they're still kicking ass. And that are those are Dawn Runner number 2, which I know Dap spoke about the first issue, and then I chimed in the next week when I read it. The second issue just came out, Ram V, Evan Cagle, Dave Stewart. Incredible. I think the second issue is better than the first, and that we start to really see the characters develop. We see a little bit more overt action. So I'm in, totally hooked. Next up is The Forged, which I talked about quite a bit after the sixth issue, because that was the wrap-up of the second arc. So we just got issue number 7, the start of the third arc, and it continues to be all kinds of kick-ass. This book, if you all don't remember, is about a bunch of badass women who are part of the sort of an elite strike force for this galactic empire. It's Greg Rucka, Eric Trautman writing it, and Mike Henderson just doing all kinds of ungodly beautiful things on the art. And then last but certainly not least, Vince, I don't know if you've had a chance to read this yet, but I'm dying to hear what you thought of it. If you find this, I'm Already Dead, number 3, which is the third and final issue of this miniseries. We talked a lot about the subsequent issue, the issues before this. Matt Kent writing, Dan McDade on art, Bill Crabtree on colors. They stuck the landing. That's all I'll say, because I don't want to spoil it, because it just came out, but I thought they stuck the landing. Loved every bit of it, and I think it's going to look great, all collected into a beautiful hardcover.
Nice. I have not read it yet, but I'm glad you didn't go into detail. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. All right, everybody. Hey, thank you for being here with us one more time around. Please note, my usual method of show notes is going to be very different for this episode, because we don't want to spill any of the beans going in. There'll be no images in the thread on 11oclockcomics.com. I will have to produce a featured image, so maybe there'll be a spoiler or three in that image, but for the most part, nothing will be revealed in the show notes, just to keep
it... Go ahead.
What?
I'm sorry. No, I just to say, but if you do want to see, well, at least my full list of all my runners-up, you could probably join the Slack to find Jason's thread announcing this topic, and my list will be in there.
There you go. So yeah, a little bit different approach. I like to keep it on the down low when we do these top lists, because who wants to know what the list is going in? Nobody. Yes. So get yourself to a comic book shop, buy some comics, love them, talk about them online. Don't start any fights, and then come to our Slack and talk about them with us, or the Facebook page, or the Instagram and stuff like that. You can go there. We have presences on all those things. So just do yourself a favor and say goodnight. I don't know why that's a favor, but just do something and say goodnight. This is not it. It's that one. David.
Goodnight.
That was a bit messy. I'm sorry. It was a bit all over the place. Chaotic, right? I am the Lord of Chaos, though.
David.
Nice. Nice. Tell them your heart beats for them.
Oh, my God. Through my chest.
Wow. It's paper thin as it is.
That is, oh, that's hurtful.
It's not hurtful.
I guess we hurt the ones translucent.
I guess we hurt the ones we love.
No, you're making shit up. It's not hurtful. It's like you're very svelte. You're very slim.
That's, yeah, but this one is a paper thin chest.
You say it was a chicken chest. That's what you
yeah.
say, but yeah.
Why is that if you call it paper thin? I mean, Jesus.
Hey, it could be worse. You could be drawn by Kurt Swan. And then you'd have to turn sideways to get through a door.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Flat man.
That's it for that one.